previously on Looking for the Tote Family.
On January 13th, 2020, Osceola County Sheriff's deputies responded to assist federal agents in serving a federal arrest warrant for Anthony Tote.
The plan was we were going to do some surveillance, if we could find any information about where this family was, because nobody had heard from them, nobody could locate them.
Approximately 7:45, I saw the guy get out of the house and sit on his front porch.
A safety check of the home was conducted where deputies discovered four deceased individuals inside.
The master bedroom door was open and you could see feet.
Anthony has cooperated with the investigation and he has confessed to killing his wife Megan Tote and their three children.
Do you have any remorse?
Are you feeling
regret?
Why do you kill your family?
Telling people you couldn't have done this.
What do you have to say to their family?
Anthony also killed their family dog, Breezy.
What about the dog? What about Breezy?
As Sheriff of Osceola County, it brings me great sadness to report, you know, such a tragedy.
From the day in New London, Connecticut, I'm Taylor Hartz.
And I'm Stud Spinella.
And this is Looking for the Tote Family.
Myself, I cannot understand what would cause a person to commit such evil and horrendous acts.
The week after the bodies were found in Florida, a vigil was held in Colchester. About 100 people gathered on the town green on a cold January night. There was snow on the ground and it was dark out, but the town green was illuminated by about 100 candles.
So that was a recording of Stephanie, who is 16, and Julian, who are 15, both music students from down in Florida. Not with the Totes, but they felt compelled to send something to honor them.
The vigil was organized in part by a woman named Erin Dobek, who was a physical therapist at Tony's practice, Family Physical Therapy.
I guess some people are asking about donations.
Organizers handed out candles and bracelets that were being sold for a dollar.
There's a table to the left of the gazebo here where we are selling bracelets for donations, or donations will be accepted for funeral costs.
They were light blue, and in dark blue writing they said, "Sweet memories. Megan, Alec, Tyler, Zoe, and Breezy."
I remember the crowd sort of slowly expanding. It just seemed like people kept on filing in because it really was at the center of Colchester.
Let us bow our heads in prayer.
At the center of the green, there's a gazebo where speakers stood to address the crowd that was gathered in the cold.
Tonight we gather at this candlelight vigil.
Father Richard Breton from St. Andrew Roman Catholic Church in Colchester led the crowd in a prayer and asked for comfort for the family as they dealt with the shock and horror of the tragedy.
Our hearts are broken today as we contemplate the numbing circumstances of this tragic news of the death of the members of our community of Colchester.
A lot of people crying, a lot of people holding hands, hugging. And I remember especially people crying during the musical performance.
My name is Avery Roble. I had made plans with Alec to vocally accompany him at a competition in May, but since they passed on, I don't have a opportunity to sing with him anymore. So this is going to be my opportunity to accompany Alec.
Amazing grace, how sweet the
From the gazebo, Erin played a video that was recorded by a young girl named Avery Roble, who used to live in Colchester but now lived in Florida, just like the Totes. In the video, Avery held up a tablet playing a video of Alec playing Amazing Grace on piano, and she sang along.
And it was really difficult to talk to people there. It was one of those situations where you didn't want to have to bother other people with questions as a reporter, but everybody seemed like they wanted to talk.
We spoke to a lot of people at the vigil. Most of them had met Tony or Megan at some point. They were old high school friends or distant cousins. And then there were a lot of folks who didn't know the family, but just felt so moved by the reason for the vigil and wanted to come there and honor the memories of this family.
I'm a reporter with the Day newspaper in New London, and I'm just speaking with folks tonight.
Throughout the night, we asked people why they came out to remember the Tope family and what they thought about the news that they learned the week before. We heard the same message over and over, a message that has echoed throughout our entire investigation, that it just didn't make any sense.
Bewilderment. I mean, no one's, you can't make sense of it. And it's stupid to try.
It didn't make sense that this beautiful family in their community was gone.
Still don't have words for it. It's pretty mind-blowing.
And it didn't make any sense that Tony, someone who was so well-respected in Colchester and had been a part of the community for so long, had allegedly committed such an atrocious crime.
None of this makes sense. They're just both loving, devoted parents. They appear to have the perfect family, and just unthinkable. And
if what?
We're still all in shock.
So right off the bat, when I was reporting in Colchester, the impression that I got from speaking to patients, friends, neighbors, and town officials in Colchester was that the Totes were a happy family that was really involved in their community and really well-respected and well-liked. They had both grown up locally in this part of the state. They were high school sweethearts. They'd been together forever. They went to prom together. They raised their kids here in Connecticut, not too far from where they grew up.
Megan and I grew up on the same road. It's a cul-de-sac of like 8 houses. So we all were very close. And she lived at the top.
Jennifer Clerken is a childhood friend of Megan's. They grew up together on Peachvale Drive in a small town called Montville.
I don't remember not knowing her. So it's one of those things where she just existed in my childhood. And her mother was an elementary school teacher. And she would have to leave early to go to her school. And so her mom and my mom decided that since she didn't want Megan getting ready by herself, that Megan would be dropped off every morning at my house and we'd get ready for school together and then walk to the bus stop, and then she would get off the bus and come to my house in the evenings and we would have our snacks and do our homework and eat dinner and then walk Megan home. So that's how we knew each other. My birthday was always in December and hers was in January, and so we would have parties almost piggybacking each other, and we always did them together. And she, I remember having chicken pox, and our moms figured it would make the most sense for us to have chicken pox together. So while I wasn't isolated, I was able to have Megan over to give her the chicken pox. So we did that together.
Jennifer told us a lot about what Megan was like as a child and as a friend over the years. And in her eyes and in the eyes of all their childhood friends, that Megan was the human embodiment of sunshine. That she had a glow to her and a light to her that lit up every room. That she was just a joyful, warm person that people gravitated towards and wanted to be around. She said that she was always the mom of the group. She was always taking care of everyone and looking after everyone and putting others' needs before her own.
She was definitely the mom of the group. The caregiver, the one who kind of looked after everybody. I don't know if you, there was a post I shared on Facebook that one time roller skating in the road, I slipped and I broke my arm. And she got together with her mom and organized all the kids in the neighborhood to sweep the road. And it made the newspaper.
She believed that Jen fell on rubbish that people had left on the street. There were like nails and crap.
Kirsten Bethman grew up on Peachvale Drive with Jennifer and Megan.
So we were all summoned to come with, bring our brooms from the house. I feel like I was like trying to sneak out a broom, and then we all had to sweep the street, all Peachvale Drive, to make sure that no kids would hurt themselves again.
Kirsten showed us a photo on her phone of a newspaper clipping from when they were kids. The Day, our paper, had run an article on Megan back in the 80s. The black and white photo on faded, crumpled newsprint shows a 10-year-old Megan sweeping their street clean with a broom that's almost as tall as her.
Kids give dangerous street sand the brush.
Oh my God.
Breaking news.
Yeah. Right. She was just the one who kind of looked out for everybody.
Looking back, Jennifer said that Megan seemed like she was just always meant to be a mom. It was just in her nature to be a caretaker.
When Megan and I were little, after Princess Diana had William, a doll came out of the baby, of her baby, similar. And I was so jealous because Megan got it before I did. And so she let me come over and we would play house with those babies for like ever, like, oh my gosh, for like weeks at a time. So yeah, she definitely, when we were little, she was just, her and I did share that where, you know, my other friends and I, my friend Amy didn't, but we loved pretending to be moms and babies and talked about when we were older and the amount of kids we would have. So yeah, that was definitely something that was in her future as well.
Everything she ever posted online suggested nothing but she was like the best mom. Physically fit, healthy, believed in like organic experiences for her kids that were unplugged. I think that all is rooted in her own childhood.
Yeah, and Gail, yeah.
We don't know much about Megan's mom, but Jennifer told us that Megan learned a lot of her healthy habits from her. Megan's mom, Gail, encouraged her to eat healthy and be active from a young age, habits that carried on to her own motherhood.
And I remember one time when we were younger and my mother used to tell us to eat all our food at dinner, and then we could go outside. And so Megan was eating and she's like, all right, I'm ready. My mom's like, Megan, like, there's still food in your plate. She's like, Mrs. Corbett, those are chips and chips is junk food. So we really don't have to eat that also. And so my mom was like, okay, lesson learned, Megan.
Though they drifted apart in high school, Jennifer said that her and Megan had reconnected a bit recently when Jennifer was experiencing a difficult pregnancy.
When I got pregnant with Maisie, because Maisie came right after, almost a year after Zoe did. And both of us were, I had my kids early, but then my second set of kids I had late, and Megan had her kids late too, so both of us kind of connected on that again. And she would constantly message me, reach out to me about how, you know, great I was doing with breastfeeding and just how she would use the cloth diapers and the all-natural baby food she made herself. And she really prided herself on all of that and was hugely encouraging when I was like, I don't know if I can do it much more. She's like, you're doing so great. Keep going. Like, you've got this in you. And I was like, so yeah, she definitely, that followed her right through into the way she parented and how she would encourage me to do the same.
Megan's aunt and uncle, who were her closest family during her years as a mother, said she was devoted to her children. When we spoke to them at the vigil, they said that Megan always had her children's best interests at heart.
She was a very lovely girl.
Peaceful, lovely, everything was from scratch, organic, cooking for all her children so they would be healthy and happy. And she was a beautiful, beautiful mother, very caring, lovely. She would do anything for her children. She started homeschooling them in Colchester, and then they moved to Florida, and the two boys were in an academy 2 days a week. They were both played beautiful piano.
Tony's father, Robert, was not around for most of his son's life, for reasons we'll talk about in a later episode. He met Megan, Tyler, and Alec only once. He told us what it was like seeing Megan as a mom to his grandchildren.
We drove over to Anthony's house, and it was Tyler, who was the baby, and Alex was probably 6, 5, something like that.
He has a memory of Megan dancing with her children in her living room that he said he'll never forget because it was just a joyful, warm memory.
The little guy, Tyler, got up, and he was still in diapers, but he was walking around. He went into the living room, and that house is full of music. I didn't know it. They all played the piano, and he goes in, and they put on some music, and he started dancing. I mean, just, you know, a two-year-old dancing, you just sit there, and you don't care about anything else. Megan got up, walked into the family room, picked the baby up, and started dancing with him. That's the image I carry of the young lady.
Bobby Sedwick is a private music teacher in Celebration who taught Alec and Tyler for nearly 2 years. She didn't want to be recorded for this podcast, but spoke to me on the record when I first started covering this case. Bobby gave both kids piano lessons and taught Alec violin and Tyler guitar. She met the family in September of 2018 and called Megan a dear friend. Bobby also homeschooled her children, and she and Megan bonded over homeschooling and motherhood, sharing lessons and recipes and a love of music. She gave the boys music lessons at the Totes house, first at their condo and then in the house they rented on Reserve Place, the house where they died. She said that Zoe would run to the door every time they arrived, greeting her with a giggle she called infectious. Zoe was quiet but curious. She was her daughter's first playdate, and she said the girls were like twins in so many ways. Alec was smart and determined, while Tyler loved to ask questions and dig into a conversation. She described Megan like so many others did, as a devoted mom who always cooked from scratch, cooking meals for her to take home to her family at the end of a long day. She said Tony was a comedian who loved to keep the room laughing. Bobby got to know the Totes very well over the few years that she taught the boys music, and she was also one of the last people to see the Totes alive. The boys performed in a recital on December 14th, and Bobby spoke to the family afterwards. A raffle had been held, and Zoe had won a month of free dance classes. Bobby said she was so excited. She talked to the family, who gave her a Christmas gift and told her to have a happy holiday. Bobby noted that the recital was holiday-themed, and students who were performing were asked to dress up, wearing an ugly sweater or some type of costume for the holidays. Bobby said that Tony, Megan, and Zoe, who sat in the audience, didn't stand out in their attire. But the boys were wearing just matching white polo shirts and blue shorts. There was nothing festive about their outfits. Other than that, Bobby said nothing seemed off about the family.
They played the piano and they acted. They were very into music. Megan was musically, she played the piano as a child and the flute. She wanted to play the flute because I would play the flute, and we would do duets at family get-togethers. And when she learned the piano, she would bring the keyboard to all the family functions.
So talented.
And
she's
so, and such a peaceful, loving,
oh, yeah,
enjoy every day.
Nothing ever got her upset. She was always so, so happy and smiling.
Did you say he's here?
I never ever saw them raise their voice to each other. The husband would never.
Whenever we would ask people about Megan and Alec and Tyler and Zoe, you know, they were always complimentary of all of them, but it was Zoe in particular that people seemed to brighten up and really get excited when they talked about her.
Oh, Zoe was just Zoe was a beautiful little girl, and Megan was so happy. She wanted a girl, and so the boys at that time were, I think, 11. Well, they were older. They were 7 and 4, or whatever. But she wanted another child. And I remember the day she came with the ultrasound, and that showed that it was a girl, and she was so happy. So she got her wish, and so it was very, very bright, just, you know, full of laughs, because they had the boys, you know, everything in the house was sort of boy, you know, centered, and now they had a girl, so, and she was a real girly girl, so she got all the frilly clothes and the dolls and everything, so.
It sounded like what people saw in Zoe was similar to how people describe Megan, which is a ball of sunshine, someone that you want to be around. And also, she sounded like she had a good sense of humor. And that she, I mean, you can, even the way I'm talking right now, Zoe always elicited the happiest reactions, or, you know, in other cases, the most desperately sad reactions from people.
Zoe was full of life. Life, fun, dancing around. If the boys were wrestling, she would go, "My boys, behave!" And she would stamp her little foot. Oh, God. And they would listen to her. And when Dad and Tyler and Alec were all wrestling around, she would say, "Okay, everyone stop. Stop. And she would get upset and she would shake her finger. Because they were going, you know, you tickle somebody, and she would say, "Now stop that."
How cute.
She ran the family.
She was just a very proud parent of all her kids, it seemed. And I remember talking with her through messaging when she found out she was pregnant with a girl, how excited she was.
As she followed Megan on social media, Jennifer talked about how Megan really seemed to have it all. She had a beautiful family. She had a happy marriage with her high school sweetheart. She had a big, beautiful home in a perfect town in Florida, close to Disney World, where she could take the kids all the time. And she told us an anecdote of how she saw Megan post a selfie on Facebook.
It was right around Halloween, and she was showing the big candy bars, that she was finally in a neighborhood where she could hand out the big candy bars. And I was like, that is goals. That's like life goals, that you can be at the top of your game to where you can pass out the huge size candy. And something so silly, but I still...
She thought to herself, she's made it. She's living the American dream. So when she heard the news of what had happened to them, she said that it just didn't make any sense with the person that she'd been seeing and the person that she'd known.
Making that comment still just baffles me. That I looked at that as like she had finally hit like this accomplishment, and I don't know, it just doesn't seem real.
Hi, I'm Jamie, host of Murderish, a true crime podcast that provides a 3D look at gripping murder cases from beginning to end. You'll get to know the victims and perpetrators, how their worlds collided, and what went down during trial. I also share some of my own personal experiences, like the time a stranger came into my bedroom at night. Yeah, that really happened, and I walk you through all the details of that terrifying night. Have you ever wanted to be a fly on the wall during a murder trial? You'll get that opportunity on Murderish, as I share my experience being a jury foreman on a first-degree murder trial. Search Murderish in your favorite podcatcher app, hit subscribe, and start binging. And remember, listening to this podcast doesn't make you a murderer. It just means you're murder-ish.
I want to thank everyone for coming tonight to honor the Todd family, and if anyone wants to say anything, that would be fine as well. Otherwise, you can stay as long as you like to pay your respects.
So at the vigil, we had a lot of people, almost a surprising amount of people, say good things about Tony, and I don't think it was in a way to defend him or claim that he wasn't responsible for what happened. People were sort of not showering him with praise, but saying a lot of good things about Tony. While we were there, it wasn't just Megan and the kids. It was about how Tony seemed like a great husband, seemed like a great father, was very talented as a physical therapist. And again, it didn't seem like they were defending Tony. It was more like they were talking to themselves out of shock, saying, how could this guy that we had known as a pillar of the community, a family man, have done this? They were just saying the person they had known. Nobody knew that he could be allegedly capable of this.
Somebody said to me, like, I couldn't understand why I was so affected by it.
Catherine McNary was a patient of Tony's.
But I think because he was a physical therapist, and he touched so many of us and so many of the kids in town that it just hit home really hard.
I know that he was coaching.
Megan's cousin Norman Rio also grew up in Mottville.
His business was sponsoring fundraisers and coat drives and just very involved in the community from what I've seen on Facebook and through conversations. So it just makes it that much more, unimaginable. He devoted his whole life to helping people, right out of college, to the medical profession.
Linda Ackerman, who had known Tony for years, attended the vigil to record a video for the Tote family.
I think everyone just needed it. I'm videotaping it for the family.
Oh, good.
They had asked me to. I usually videotape a lot of stuff in town.
Okay.
And so that's what I'm kind of trying to be inconspicuous with.
Yes.
It. But I think it's something that, like, they'll want, uncut. The whole thing.
I had Absolutely. Spoken with Linda the day that the bodies were found, and pretty often in the weeks following. She's very tied into the Colchester community and was receiving dozens of messages and posts about the Tote family murders. And she said that she hadn't been able to stop thinking about it since she first heard the news, and that she felt like that's what most residents of Colchester were experiencing. By the time the vigil took place, about a week and a half after the bodies were found, she said that she felt the mood in the town had shifted from shocked to angry. She said that Colchester residents were not only mourning the loss of a family that they knew, but they were mourning the loss of a friend, realizing that he wasn't who they thought he was.
Colchester, Connecticut is situated approximately 2 hours from New York and 2 hours from Boston. It's a bedroom community of about 16,000 people.
You know, you drive through and it's kind of quaint.
The town, like many other Connecticut towns, combines a suburban and rural feel.
Back roads, you see your typical farming and like the small farms. And
when you drive through Colchester's downtown center, on one side there's a row of shops and restaurants, and on the other side is a large town green, the kind you might see in any small New England town.
One of our biggest things that I most love about our town is our town green. Everything happens on that green. It's the most busy green that I think I've ever seen in every... almost year-round, there's activities, especially in the summer. Every week, there's a big event, everywhere from carnivals to, you know, car shows on. And then even during the school year, kids are playing, you know, football and sports on it after school.
I remember being struck by how large it was, so it doesn't surprise me that there's a lot of activity on it.
You know, so it's just a quaint little town. I think anything can happen anywhere. I'm not as much surprised over that as I am surprised over that it happened to the person that I never would have thought it would have happened to. You know, I would imagine, like I said, something like this could have happened in our town, yeah. But not with him.
Linda also coached youth soccer in Colchester, never with Tony, but they knew each other from the running in the same soccer circles. And she started off by telling me that everyone that she'd spoken to that day was just in utter disbelief that something may have happened to the Totes.
Like I said, it's still none of this makes sense, and you just want to know why.
She said that they were a well-known family in the community, and that Tony, especially, was almost like a hometown celebrity in Colchester. He was the favorite soccer coach of so many young players over the years. And he was a talented physical therapist.
Anytime my sons went in for therapy.
Linda, her husband, and their sons were all patients of Tony's.
I would always go with them, and I would sit, and Tony and I would talk.
Linda had been seeing Tony for a few years on and off for a back injury, and both of her sons had gone to Tony for various sports-related injuries over the years.
So we just became good friends, and then we connected about soccer particularly, and like I said, he was coaching, and a lot of it, he was also, I think early on, he was asking me about how do you get involved in sponsoring. So I was very involved in Little League in town, and we could always use sponsorships, those banners, and so I know he talked about that.
Her youngest son had actually developed a pretty close relationship with Tony.
Oh yeah, my son is not keen on doctors at all. You know, it became a kind of a joke in our house. You know?
She said that he was the only medical professional that he not only didn't dread going to, but actually kind of looked forward to.
A couple of times we'll have to bring it up to him. Is your knee sore? Is something sore? And he'll be like, yeah, do you want to see a doctor? No. How about if we see Tony? Okay.
He really enjoyed doing physical therapy with Tony and looked up to him as kind of a cool adult that he got along with and had similar interests in sports with and could really talk to and connect with.
Was it almost like that fatherly kind of conversations with him, you know? They were, you know, Tony would talk to him about college or what are you going to do or, you know, girlfriends or, you know, whatever. And then I would show up, you know, or I'd stop by and he would just, and they were goofing and laughing and, you know, Tony'd be like, you know, your son just said this, and you know, Jason just said this or that, and You don't fake that.
Linda posted a picture of one of her son's sessions with Tony on Facebook back in 2015.
I've taken a couple of others, you know, every time they were together, that's the one I posted, because they were just, you know, the whole, as you see him, he's working on his knee. And
she talked about how Tony put her son at ease.
But they were just laughing and just catching up and talking about soccer and talking about school. And it, the conversation was, like I said, like literally like two friends catching up. So, and they both knew I took the picture. And, you know, it's one of those times also my son was okay with me taking a picture of, because it was with Tony.
Tony was very quiet, conscientious.
We learned a lot about what Tony and Megan were like in high school from Deborah Sakowitz, who went to Montville High School with them and was mostly friends with Tony.
Just a very nice kid, one of those people that everybody was friends with. He got along very well with everyone.
Deborah gave us a good window into who Tony was.
We ended up becoming part of student council and the peer leadership team together.
And he sounds like he was similar to the adult version of him. Good-natured, well-liked.
The peer leadership team was handpicked by class advisors of a group of students that would be there to help tutor kids or be there if kids needed somebody to talk to, and we were part of that group as well. So he was very much admired by both students and faculty.
I really enjoyed talking to Deborah because she had a relationship with Tony all the way from high school, and she really liked Tony a lot. She said that she never could have imagined, nor did she ever see him putting on a bad face.
Funny. I mean, to honestly, to see him and to know him, you wouldn't think that there would be a mean bone in his body whatsoever. My mind is absolutely blown. Like, I never in a million years. There are people out there that would have been like, oh yeah. But not Tony. Definitely not. I was absolutely taken aback. I still think there's still more that's going to come out because this so much just doesn't make sense. I cannot wrap my mind around.
We wanted to find out more about who Tony and Megan were in high school. So we thought a good way to do that would be to consult the yearbooks, which posed some bureaucratic issues because they weren't available in the public library anymore. And I had to go through the superintendent. And Montville's superintendent eventually had me come in to the high school, to the administration's office, to a conference room to look through the yearbooks that we requested. I wasn't totally sure of the time frame, so I looked at every yearbook from like 1990 to 98. I was there for 2 hours, and I had to come back the next day to finish looking at the yearbooks because there was so much in there. And the first photo you see of Tony as a freshman is this string bean with floppy hair, and he's smiling without teeth. He looks unassuming and almost a little nerdy. And from what we found out about his high school career, if nerdy means very involved, then he was that. He was a soccer captain and was on the soccer team all 4 years. He was in the Spanish Honor Society, the Honor Society, the Student Council, and he was also class president his junior and senior years. But maybe the most interesting part we found was that his senior year superlative was most likely to succeed. Megan was younger than Tony. She was involved in a lot of things at school as well, including tennis. She played the flute. There are photos of her in the yearbook of her in a full band uniform. The first photo I saw of Tony and Megan together was in his senior yearbook. He had a photo of them together at a school dance, looking very happy, all dressed up. Then the other photo I saw of them together is in her senior yearbook. She included a photo of them standing with Disney mascots Goofy and Pluto, smiling ear to ear. Tony's senior box of personal info includes his nicknames, Antoine and Pele, and he left a personal message. Megan, the best of times I've had have been with you. You are very special to me and always will have a place in my heart. Love you. Megan's senior personal info box said her nicknames were Meg, Mego, Lego, my ego, Mego. Her message starts with her mom and dad. She says, "You've been more help than you'll ever know. I appreciate everything. Thanks. I love you." Then she goes to Tony. "I'd rather be a bumble than a bee. You've been there for me for over 3 years. I want you to know I'll always have time to be there for you. Love ya." I felt like I understood or knew Tony and Megan for the first time during this process when I looked through those yearbooks. I don't know if it was just being alone in a room with them for 4 hours that made me feel as if these are people I could have known. These are people I could have gone to high school with. I wasn't surprised. It just seemed too obvious, I guess, that Tony was class president, chosen as most likely to succeed, a soccer captain, on student council in the honor society. All of that was like, you had to have made this up. That sounds like a fictional story. That sounds like TV. No way this guy was, I mean, he was a pillar of the community before he was even an adult. It seems like he ran that high school and he was very social and had friends. And him and Megan, I mean, there seems to be a classic love story. And they just sort of, at least just from like myself looking at these photos, they looked like an all-American kids next door, happy marriage, the type that you see in movies and TV shows that doesn't actually exist, or you have that one friend whose parents were high school or college sweethearts.
I remember when Megan first started dating him, and even through school, he was not, like, when they were together, you never in a billion years would have assumed anything like this could have occurred. A friend of mine, another one of our close friends, she was in student council with him. And she's will be the first one to say that she was like, that's not the Tony Toe I knew. You know, she was like, it just doesn't make sense.
Thinking about how everybody has said, this doesn't make sense and nobody knows why. And as a journalist, we are trying to figure out why. We're trying to learn more. We're trying to figure out how it makes sense. And the more I learned, the less it made sense.
He was her first everything, like her first boyfriend, her first serious relationship.
They were very close. They had a really strong friendship and bond. They really did. And I remember years down the road when I went through my divorce, I remember thinking, gosh, you know, I really envy that. And I hope someday I can actually have that. Because they really seemed to have it together. They really did. They had a lot of fun together. They laughed. They smiled.
Deborah showed us some photos, some really adorable photos of Tony and Megan playing with the kids on bikes or, you know, going on trips, family photos with everybody smiling. And she also talked about how proud Tony was of the kids and showed us messages of, you know, when she would ask how he is, he might be honest about, you know, maybe some things aren't going great in his life, but he would always come back to how great the kids are doing, how much him and Megan love the kids, how much time he spends with them. They seem to be the most important thing to him and Megan, especially according to their Facebook pages. I mean, the only thing, the main things I remember from seeing their Facebook pages are either, you know, loving comments to each other on photos of each other or, you know, loving photos of their kids talking about how great a time they're having.
I didn't know the adult Tony on an everyday basis. You know, he would just send me messages asking how I was doing, things like that. He actually helped. He gave me some advice when my daughter broke her finger ice skating. You know, I said, you know, is there any, it's a pinky finger. Does she need to go to therapy? He's like, no, just have her do these exercises. I said, okay, great. He saw a picture of my mother and I on Facebook, and my mom is on oxygen. And he messaged me right away. He's like, why is mom on oxygen? And I said, oh, she's been on for years, Tony. But, you know, he was always genuinely concerned about people. So it just makes all of this so difficult to comprehend. I know that he valued his family. He was so in love with Megan. He would text me on and off about pictures of the kids, as a matter of fact. October 14th of this year was the last time I heard from him. And he sent me a video of Zoe on her scooter singing the Day of the Week song. I had to share. It's so cute. This is very cute. And there, it's just, I think we took pride in just sharing our kids, you know. Like, look how big they've gotten. Oh my God, whoever would have thought years ago, you know. So, yeah. And he would send pictures of Megan, too. So he, you know, and this is what he did with his friends. He would brag and send pictures about his family. Which makes everything just even more crazy.
Everybody talked about how great a guy Tony was, and even Megan's family, who are not related by blood to Tony, were saying nice things about him and talking about how great a dad he was.
He was unbelievable. He loved his children so much. We can't, none of us can believe that ever
happened. It doesn't match at all.
Nothing.
The last time I saw him with the kids, he was feeding the baby. He was feeding the baby girl and was perfectly natural doing it.
Yeah.
Perfectly natural doing it.
Oh my God, the kids would be climbing on him.
Yep. At the front of the crowd at the vigil was a woman named Elizabeth Campbell, Megan's uncle's sister. She held up a large sign attached to a pole that towered above the crowd. It featured a photo of Megan embracing the children and said, "Remember them with love." She told us that she made the sign because she wanted people to focus on the warm memories they had with them while they were alive, and not just on how they died.
Everybody was essentially trying to preserve this image of the family as a happy unit. You know, something so gruesome and unbelievable had just happened. Nobody really wanted to reckon with the possible evil or tragic qualities of this.
At the vigil, it seemed like everyone we spoke to really wanted to focus on the happy memories that they had of the family. And that's something that you hear often reporting on crimes and death. People don't really want to talk about the details of a crime. They want to talk about the good things that happened when their loved one was alive.
They wanted to remember how great a mom Megan was, how polite and talented all the children were. They didn't want to talk about what went wrong. At the funeral for Megan and the kids in Montville about a week later, Mike Caplet, Tony's sister Chrissy's brother-in-law, delivered a eulogy where he urged everybody in attendance to remember the good times. He said to remember Megan when you cook, as she spent countless hours in the kitchen with her aunt and grandmother. He told everyone to remember Princess Zoe and her sassy self, to remember Alec's compassion, to recall Tyler's sense of humor. He said to be happy for the time extended family had with the totes, and to be sad for those who didn't get the chance to know them.
It's human nature to want to remember the positive, the highlight reel of those we've lost. But it's also in our nature to look for an explanation, to demand answers when something just doesn't make any sense. Was Tony the class president, Tony the devoted husband, Tony the doting father, just a facade? Was something broken inside of him all along? Or did something inside him, or someone in that house, just snap? How do we reconcile this picture-perfect, all-American family with the horror of what happened in that house?
I mean, how can you not ask yourself what happened to that skinny high school athlete? You know, the kid that was friends with everybody, the class president, most likely to succeed. How did this kid end up overweight and emotionless, being led to a police car in shackles in front of TV cameras.
Are you sad about this?
Say something.
The pictures of Tony that they show, you don't see Tony. You definitely don't see Tony in those pictures. At some point, it seems like a switch was flipped and something happened.
It doesn't even make sense. The clutch of friends we have that lived on that road, we've been texting, messaging each other like almost daily because none of us can make sense of this. Like, it's just so mind-boggling. It just shows you what you see on Facebook's obviously not what's in real life. Because none of us, from what Megan reached out to all of us and how she portrayed her life on Facebook, obviously wasn't what was going on. Like, you know, they had struggles that we didn't know of at all. It was beyond shocking because, everything about it was shocking because Megan prided herself on, I don't even like using the word like health food nut, because she wasn't like, she was very conscious of her health and her, the way she carried herself and the way she took care of her kids and how she continued to do yoga and was all natural, everything. And when I saw the picture of Tony, to me, he seemed like the polar opposite of everything that Megan was. You know, he looked very unkempt and very not healthy and just overweight, just everything opposite than her. And so a part of me still to say wonders like what went so wrong.
Next time on Looking for the Tote Family.
He was gaining quite a bit of weight, and obviously not eating healthy, not sleeping. Yeah, we knew he was under a lot of stress.
He had kind of made a reference that it's all just getting to him, like it was all like he was tired.
And that's when she had said to, maybe you should find another therapist.
On the same day Tot was arrested in Florida for the murder of his family, the U.S. attorney here in Connecticut tells me that he was also arrested for healthcare fraud.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Looking for the Tote Family on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to rate the show. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Looking for the Tote Family is hosted and reported by Taylor Hartz and Sten Spinella. Produced by Peter Huapi and Carlos Virgen. Written by Taylor Hartz, Sten Spinella, and Peter Huapi. Editing by Peter Huapi and music by Carlos Virgen. Tim Cotter is our executive editor. Inizaskun Larnieta is our managing editor. Social media management by interns Josette Moses and Allison O'Donnell. This has been a production of The Day in New London, Connecticut.